Good morning. We've got the video going, so we're going to get started now. Sorry for the delay. I'm Justin Marks. I'm a program manager in Visual Studio. With me is Brian Crawford, our architect, and we're going to be talking a bit about the new SDK that comes along with Visual Studio for the new feature called IntelliTrace. Yesterday, with the release of the new version in Beta 2, we actually had a new branding. It's pretty exciting for us as a feature team to get to actually get a true brand for our feature. Throughout Beta 1 and all the previous times that I've spoken to this group, it's been called Historical Debugger or Historical Debugging, and now we have a brand new brand that we're pretty proud of and we're pretty excited about. And as part of Beta 2, it's actually in the product as IntelliTrace. So if anybody has seen actually, let's start with that. How many people have actually either used the Historical Debugger or have seen a talk about it or know about it in the past? Oh, cool. So about half the room or so. Well, now you'll start hearing it referred to as IntelliTrace, so sorry for the confusion, but comes with the product cycle. So to get going, I think it's best to kind of introduce the feature, talk a little bit about what the rationale for it was, what the problems we're hoping to solve with it, give a couple of demos, and then Brian's going to come up and he can talk about the extensibility and how you can make use of not just the feature, but building on top of our platform. So when we first sat down to start working as part of the diagnostics team, we did a lot of surveys of developers, went out to communities, and started to find out how developers actually do diagnostics as a part of the process. What do they do for debugging? And we realized pretty quickly that the experience for debugging was rather poor. Most developers have their own methodology for doing debugging, as I'm sure all of you do. But when it comes to working with test organizations or working with production organizations, it was really hard to find out what was the environment that the problem occurred in. How do we prevent ourselves from getting into that no repro problem? How are we able to have the right tools at the time the problem occurred to be able to find out what went wrong, as opposed to after the fact trying to reproduce it, trying to figure out, let me try to configure my environment, let me set up a whole bunch of settings, get a whole bunch of tools off the shelf, etc. So what we wanted to do was give a very quick and easy tool built into the Visual Studio debugger that would give all that information to you right up front and give you, the developer, the power of being able to tune how much information you wanted to get. So again, we were eliminating this no repro problem. Not only are we doing this as a part of the debugging experience, but we're also doing this as a part of the test experience for a full end-to-end. So not only are developers able to do this as a part of the F5 experience, but testers in their testing organization are able to run their application, run it under test with the Microsoft Test and Lab Manager, and then be able to get back a log file automatically added to a bug anytime the problem occurs. So the developer has something much more rich than just a simple set of repro steps to try to figure out what went wrong and solve their problem. So at its bare bones, IntelliTrace is an application flight recorder that's integrated with the debugger. By that I mean it collects a list of events similar to what you are used to seeing in FileMon or RegMon. But instead of just being around files and registry accesses, we're getting events across many different parts of the .NET framework. So you're able to get a full, not a full, but a much broader insight into how the application is using the framework. What .NET call or what ADO.NET calls were made, what calls to ASP.NET, what calls to WCF, what registry, resources, environment variables were accessed, et cetera. So you're able to see exactly what happens. This is very, very helpful, especially when you're reusing code or using library code from other people that you might not know what the implications of using that code are. That's a part of the default experience, but that doesn't always solve all of our developer problems. Sometimes you need to get more information. For that, we actually have a turn up the dial type of UI. We're able to turn on a much richer set of collection and get a complete call hierarchy for your entire application. Of course, that does have a bit of a performance impact on your debugging session, but you're able to get a much broader set of data about the application as it's executing. And that builds you an entire execution flow. And finally, all of this is integrated with the debugger. So you don't have to be pulling in different tools. You don't have to learn a whole new UI. All of the familiar windows that you're used to with the debugger are going to work with IntelliTrace. All the simple debugger commands, F10, F11, they work with IntelliTrace. Of course, there's some new UI and some new windows you can use as well, but it's really integrated as a part of the debugging experience, and we'll see that in a minute. So, actually, let's just get right into the demo. So, we're going to open up a simple application that I like to use for demos here. It's a card game application. I'm a pretty big blackjack fan, so we'll use this as a demo. And basically, we'll start off and we'll just push F5. And I'm just using, this is the exact same experience you'll see by just installing Visual Studio. I haven't changed any settings. So my application comes up. I'm able to click on my new game button. My little user icon will come up. And I'm able to start placing a bet. So I want to bet $10. So I click on my $10 bet, and I should be good to go. Unfortunately, something went wrong, and my bet shows up as $25, not that $10 that I was expecting. Now, this is a pretty simple VB application, and most of us would be able to solve that problem with code inspection, but do we really want to even go through the bother of doing that? Wouldn't it be easier if we were just told right away what went wrong, especially if this came from somebody else and somebody had collected this log file and done it on their box, and you might not even know what they had done or what the exact steps they had taken to get this problem to occur. It would be nice to have that information collected at the time the problem happened. In this case, I'm just going to break into the debugger at this point and see what information IntelliTrace gives me to help me solve the problem. I'm just going to expand the view here so we can help. So on the right-hand side of the window, we have a new IntelliTrace window. And this is that flat list, sequential list of events that took place during the application's recording. And we can see right away that there was a gesture event or a user action event where the user clicked the button. And if I click on that, it'll actually go back in time, change the instruction pointer to the point at the line where that occurred. And because it was a gesture event, it actually does the rerouting. Instead of going through the WinProc, it actually goes right to the event handler. So you're no longer doing the search and hunt and peck method of finding your event handlers. It just brings you right to where you need to be. We can also see exceptions that were thrown in this case, in this application. In this case, there was some sort of invalid URI, and clicking that will also go to the point where that exception was thrown. If there was a catch block and we clicked on the caught exception, it would go to the catch handler as opposed to the throw. So you're also able to get to see all your exceptions without having to turn on your exception handling for first chance exceptions, without getting that annoying little pop-ups. It's just a sequential list that you're able to work with easily. And finally, I'm able to get to the point where I clicked on that $10 bet. And when I go there, I'm immediately brought to my event handler. And just by looking at the event handler's name, 25 button click, it was probably just a mismatch of my event handlers. And sure enough, looking at the code, the handler is backwards. This should have been the 25 button, and this one should have been the 10 button. So without even having to start learning the code base, I was able to easily get right to the point of the problem, and I'd be able to solve that. So I'm going to stop that, make the quick change here, and we'll just go on with the demo. So I can push F5. I have no idea what's going on there. Yes, we'll replace it. Why not? Okay. Well, we're not going to fix the bug because there's some sort of lock on the file, but it's not going to really matter. So if I push F5, I continue my debugging session. Note, I haven't actually stopped and restarted the debugger. Most of the time, developers are sitting there stopping and restarting. I've been able to get all this information as a part of the debugger experience without having to do anything. So I'm going to click New Game again. I'll go back in, make a bet, and now we're just going to deal our hand. And I get two aces as my deal, and it's showing up as zero as the sum. This is a type of a bug where probably the flat list of events is not going to help solve the problem. This was all user code. There was a bunch of math calculation going on. It's not a use problem. It's more of a user code problem. For that, we want to have a richer set of information. We want to see exactly what the execution flow was through the application. So I'm actually going to stop the debugging experience, and we'll go into how you change those settings. So under Tools Options, there's a new IntelliTrace right under the debugger. And from there, right away, you're presented with two options. You can obviously turn it off if you'd like, but you can choose to use the events only, which is the default mechanism, or we could kick it up a notch and collect full call information, which I'm going to do. And of course, it gives me a little warning saying that I have to restart the application to experience those new settings. So when I restart the application, I've got this new mode. I'm still going to collect all those events that I had in that flat list, but now I'm also getting a recording of every single call along with its parameters and every return or every exit of a function along with its return values. So I'm going to do the exact same steps that I did before. We'll click New Game, bet $10, we'll deal. So far it looks good. Ace plus 3 is 14. I'm going to hit again. I get another ace, and suddenly it's back down to 3. So there's something wrong there. So I'm actually going to break in again. And now, instead of looking at the flat list view, I'm actually going to switch over to my calls view. And from the call view, I can see a complete hierarchy, or like a tree view, of how the application executed. The top portion of this window is identical to what we would see in the call stack. You're able to see all the code that executed to get to the current function. The bottom view, however, is a listing of all the siblings of the current call, so or all of the places that also went from underneath show dialog. And again, I want to actually follow along as I click through, so I'm going to go to the point where I click the hit button, and then from there, we can see that right away it brings over. And then if I go to the next call, which is the hit button click handler, I can actually double-click that and drill into that, and then I can start walking through my application. So one way is obviously I can continue to double-click and drill in through this window. That's not a bad experience, but it might not be exactly what I'm looking for. Sometimes we want to be able to set a breakpoint and step. Sure enough, we have the full functionality of being able to step through history just like you would as if it was a live session. So at this point, I'm at the beginning of this function, and if I press F10, I can then go from method call to method call, not line by line. We're not a line-level collector. We're a method-level collector. But I'm able to then use the same F10, F11 keys that I'm used to using as a part of my debugging session, but I'm navigating through history. These are already executed methods. In addition to the keyboard shortcuts, we have our new gutter controls here for users to first experience the feature. They're able to just click through those and see what the event handlers are for that as well, and they're able to execute in that manner. So there's a couple different ways you can execute. I'm going to just go through here and actually scroll down to the point where this is Blackjack, here we go. Going to open up another file. So another thing we can do is sometimes we know exactly where the problem is, or we have an idea of where the problem is, and we want to just get to that point of the code without having to step line by line. And we're able to actually do that with the historical debugger. One of the ideas is basically, where would you have set the breakpoint, and can I jump to that point? We don't support breakpoints in historical, but we do support being able to search back to a previous point in the application. So I'm actually going to update or jump to where the calculation for the hands value is, which is, where is it? Oh, sorry, that's not this one, the card game framework, hand. Just gotta scroll down, here we go, get sum of hand. So I'm actually going to right click in this method, and in the context menu there are two new commands, one for search for this line and one for search for this method. If I do search for this method, it's actually going to start a search and find all the instances of that method being called through the history of that application. And I'm able to just click through the arrows and navigate through them. So I'm going to click the next button. It immediately jumps me right to that function. So I didn't have to sit there stepping through. I didn't have to figure out how I got there. And if I look in the IntelliTrace window, I have that full execution history shown in this window. But I'm quickly able to get right to where I want to start my investigation. And from there, I can then walk through the application and see what happened. So if I click step, I can, and also, let me back up for a second. If I look in the autos window, in the call stack window, the debugger windows we're used to using, all the information we'd expect is seen there. So at the method enter, I'm able to see that I have a return, that this function returned 3, so we are recording the return variables. So this was the exact method call I was interested in. That was obviously wrong. It should have been something more like 15. I'm able to expand me and see all the children, so we do collect hierarchies of data as well. And the call stack window, of course, does show us where we are currently situated. So I'm going to step F10 and start watching and seeing what happens. So the first card that I have was an ace, and it returned the face value of it was an ace. And then if I look and walk, it then does the next one. In this case, there was a 3, and the value of that card is obviously 3. And I can see that here in my autos, actually, through the locals window. See that when I evaluated an ace, evaluated 3, it did return 3. And we can walk through again. And at this point, it says, okay, there were a total of my hand is currently 3. I have 2 aces in my hand, and now I'm about to make a call out to this value of aces function to calculate how much the aces value is. Again, I can push F11, step through that function. And as I step through that function, I can see that it returned a value of 0. Now, this function didn't have any actual methods called from it, which is why I'm not able to step line by line. But at least I'm able to get down to the point where this is the function that's the problem. I passed in a hand total of 3 with 2 aces, and I got back out a value of 0 as the value of those aces. So there's obviously something wrong. It should have been more like 12. So that's a quick way of how we can use the IntelliTrace to execute through application. Are there any questions about this at this point before we get into the extensibility? Yeah.
Those instructions or just retrieve the history. So in other words, will side effects happen again?
Okay, so the question was, are we doing re-execution or are we just viewing historical data? It's actually viewing, it's the secondary, it's viewing historical data. Every time we actually make a call, well, actually what we're doing when we're in the high mode, and that gets into our next slide, is we're instrumenting the user's application. So we're making changes to the IL, and we're actually storing all the information at method enter of what values were passed in and what the call stack was. And we throw that in a log file, and whenever you're navigating the information, you're navigating the log. You're not able to re-execute. You're not going to see any side effects. You're not going to even do any changes to the application. All you're doing is looking back. Your live instruction pointer, you can just start running from this point again because it's still sitting there waiting, just as if you had walked back the double-clicking the call stack, for instance. But you just have a richer set of data.
So you can't change the past in an continued fashion?
Correct. There is no changing of the past. There's no re-execution. Yes? How long is the history buffer? So actually, we can go into the settings, and I can go over that quickly. So one of the settings is, one of the questions is, how big is the buffer? How much hard drive space do you take up for this? If you go to the advanced settings, you're able to actually tune how much information you want to collect and what size you want to make the log file. One setting, it tells you exactly where the log files are, and the other setting is how big you want to make the log file. By default, we're limiting it to 100 megabytes, but you can change that to no limit, a couple gigs, whatever you actually want to do. In this instance, I actually have a directory already open, and you can see that the log file that we've currently collected is 16 megs. Now, one of the other things we do is if we do allow you to limit that collection to 100 megabytes, and what we'll do is if we've already reached that 100 megabytes and filled our buffer, we're going to start removing data from the beginning of the log and compressing the information down to be able to save space in that place. So you do lose some fidelity of earlier events in the log, but you're able to condense it to hopefully have the problem at the end of the log and limit the amount of space, which is very helpful in a test scenario because you don't want to be having multiple gigabyte log files for every single test case that you're running. Yes?
Can these traces be generated from release builds or just from debug builds?
So the question is, do you need to have debug or check bits on to be able to get them? No, you're able to get this from release. You're able to do this without symbols even. So you're able to really have a true developer experience around this.
Native code support?
So the question is there native code support? No, we do not support native code. This is a managed only feature in this release, but it's of course something we're looking at in future releases. We know probably our biggest ask today is being able to support this in native code. Yes?
Along the same lines, I assume there's no way that I could hook up a custom debug engine to this functionality.
Could you hook up a custom debug engine?
So I'm not sure with the intent of your question, but the next part we're going to talk about here is how you can actually use the data that's recorded in the log file using our extensibility API to write custom tools or other types of analysis.
Mm-hmm. You might have created your own debug engine to work with your own language in Visual Studio and implemented the debugging interfaces.
Oh.
I'm not sure now, are these extensibility APIs such that I could then implement them and get historical debugging with my own customers?
Okay. So actually, the extensibility does not do that, and we'll get into that. But as far if you are a first-class citizen and you have your own language and have fully implemented it, is a part of the .NET framework, as a part of the IDE, you will be able to collect these logs for your custom language.
But it would have to be a .NET language.
Yes, it would have to be a .NET language. It would have to be a true managed language that meets the full specification.
Gotcha.
Yeah, can I add on to that just for a second? So yeah, if you're using the debug engine APIs, writing your own debug engine, the APIs, we obviously have some implementation under this for supporting this for .NET. Those APIs are not public in this release, so you can't add that functionality to your own debug engine. Yep.
Yes?
So going back to the release code
yep.
question, what if the release code is obfuscated?
I know we've had that question in the past, and I believe we did some investigation that if you have obfuscation enabled, we still will collect. I think there's some problems in terms of the way we display some of the results, but we are able to get collection, and from the flatless and the low mode, you're definitely able to get full fidelity information because those are just .NET framework APIs. Yes? Actually, I should be able to load one. So the question is, what is the experience if you're tracing through a multi-threaded app? It's pretty much no different than if you are in a traditional debugging and session tracing through a multi-threaded app without having historical debugging. We do support all the threads, and if you go to the threads window, double-clicking a thread, you're able to switch that. We have multi-project support, so if you have multiple projects that you're doing, we're collecting a different log for each of the processes, so it's not a single log, but we are able to transition between those and see the information. And then when you actually get, let me just load that up in the background. It's a first class. I mean, we know that most people are using multi-threaded applications, and we do fully support them. I'm actually going to load up an ASP.NET application, which is a pretty good example of that. And just for simplicity, I'm just going to turn the log down back to the default setting of low, and we'll be able to do a quick demo of that. Show a couple of additional features there. Are we okay on time for your second?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, I don't know why solutions are under source control, but that's not a problem for now. Are any other questions while I get this demo loaded? Yes?
What if we just ship a component to a customer and they run this trace on their whole product and there's a, say, a bug in the component?
Okay, so
we just analyze that one piece of the log file?
So the question is, there's a couple things there. First, if you ship, let's say, a library, and a user uses that library, you're debugging the application. You're not debugging your library. You are able to make some custom changes to the collection plan in terms of limiting that, but it's not really a public-facing feature that we're exposing as a first-class citizen. But we can talk with you about ways of doing some of that. I don't know why that's going like that. Any other questions? So I think we're open now. So let's just change this. Go back here.
What kind of overhead is there for the load? I mean, are you going to be able to notice that?
So our goals around low, the question was, what is the overhead of low? Our goals around low, I don't know why this is a problem. There we go. Our goals when we were working on development of the feature to begin with was to basically have very low overhead. We wanted to be on by default, which is what we are today. It always depends on your application. If you have lots and lots of events turned on, it's obviously going to have a larger impact. If you're writing trace methods for every single line of your application and we're collecting thousands and thousands of events, you're going to see an impact. We've tuned it, though, for most typical applications not to experience that. And any events that we found that are called very, very often, we actually have disabled by default. Along those lines, let me just bring that up real quickly.
Your login isn't being set.
That's probably why. Okay. So actually, in the settings, you're able to see a list of all the diagnostic or all the IntelliTrace events that we have defined. And some of them are turned on, some of them are turned off. Accesses to file we found were a little too costly because we weren't sure, especially in ASP.NET scenarios when you're opening hundreds of resources, we were getting lots of events. So we didn't want to turn those on by default. When you're opening some very large applications like Visual Studio, the number of registry keys that you access is insane. So we didn't want to have registry keys on by default. But of course, you can just check the checkbox and turn those collections on, and based on your own application, tune what you want your settings to be for your organization. And all these settings, yes, these are shown in the UI, but there's also an XML file on the box where all these settings come from, and you're able to edit that XML file and then share that out with your team if you'd like. Other questions? Don't know why this multi-threaded application isn't working, so I think it's because of the user permissions, but it does work for multi-threaded. You're actually able to switch it through the threads window, and if you get this, one of the interesting features is if you get this from a test scenario or you open a log file after the fact, you're actually given a full timeline view of all the threads of the application, and you can then just double-click on which thread you're interested in. So you're able to get a visual representation of threads as well. Any other questions? All right, so I think we're going to hand it over to Brian now, and he's going to talk a little bit about the extensibility and how you can actually make use of these log files. I have no idea what the situation settings are now, but okay. You've got the logs. You should be okay.
Actually, switch here for a second. So hi, I'm Brian Crawford. I'm an architect on the team that built this. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how we take the collected data that you were seeing through Visual Studio and write your own tools around that recorded data. This slide here is basically kind of breaking down how IntelliTrace works. You just saw the demo of how this works from describing what you want to collect to instrumentation and collecting data about the application while it's running, and then recording the data in a log file and then seeing that in Visual Studio. So what I want to switch over to now is talking a bit about the log file that's actually been collected. So behind this, we're writing out a log file. You saw that you can set the size of it and those kinds of things. And we kind of think of this as three concepts of this. One is that inside that log file, we have a simple object model over that where you can see the processes that were collected, the threads that were part of those processes, and then the modules that were loaded. So it's pretty simple, but it gives you kind of an object model over the collected data. The second concept that we have is this notion of events. So each time something interesting happens in the application or one of those instrumentation points, we record an event in the log file. And through this API that I'm going to show you, you can actually get at those events and decode them and start to write your own analysis tools around them. And we'll write a simple app here today to show how that works. And then the third concept is data. So you saw when Justin was showing the demo, we could see data in the locals window and the autos window about the parameters and the return values that were collected as the functions were called while the program was running. You can also get at that data through our extensibility, and we'll see that a little bit today as well. So I'm going to actually run the card game a little bit more. I want to collect a little bit more data than Justin collected, just so we have enough in the log file to make it an interesting... Oh, thanks, yeah. And let's turn it back to high, too, so that we can get a lot of good data collected here. So I'm just going to run the app again under the debugger, and we're just going to click through a few more. So let's go ahead and run this a few times. You can see we still have that bug in there where the ace is being miscounted. Great. So we've got a few times through the deal routine there. We'll have a little bit more data to collect to analyze here. Now, the first thing I'm going to do here to set this up is this is the directory where the log files are actually written to. It's in the advanced settings on the tools options. So you can always go see it there. And the log file we just created is this this latest one right here. So I'm going to go ahead, because these log files will get deleted by Visual Studio when you open new projects or when you shut down Visual Studio, I'm going to go ahead and copy this to a location where we can continue to use it, even though we're not going to continue to use this project. So the first thing you need to do to use the API is actually create a new project to use it. So I'm going to just create a simple console app. And what we're going to do is we're going to just do some statistics over the log file. So we're going to count some things up that are in the log file just to get at what the API can do. So we're going to create this run stats sample. And just to make this a little easier to see, we're going to do this. Okay, so the first thing we need to do is add a reference to the assembly that contains the API. And this, this assembly is installed with Visual Studio. And it's called microsoft.visualstudio.tracelog. And as soon as we can sort this list, we'll be able to find it. There we go. So it's right here. We go ahead and add that reference to our project. And we'll add a using as well around that so that we can get access to the APIs that are in there. So we go ahead and add that. And the first thing we want to do is open the log file. And to make this a little easier, I'm not going to type in all the code. I've got bits of code here that we'll use to walk through how we use this API. So the first thing we want to do is open the log file. And it's pretty easy to do. We just create an instance of the trace debug log file class. And its constructor just takes a path to the log file. So we put that in the temp directory, and that was our file name. And then all we're going to do here just to start with is just dump out the fact that we opened the log file. And from the log file, there's a few interesting properties on here. One's file name, one is a list of the processes that are in the log file. For now, let's just dump out the file name so we can make sure it opened and we're good to go. Let's go ahead and run this now. And you can see our output just says we opened the log file essentially, so we're reading that log file. So let's start to do some more interesting things. Let's go through and enumerate the processes that are in that log file using this API. So what we can do from here is, as you saw on the log file, there's that processes collection. So we can actually just for each through that processes collection. Now, in this release, in the Visual Studio 2010 release, there's actually only ever one process in the log file, but this API is set up for when we're able to record more than one process in a log file. So here we're going to go through the processes. There's only going to be one. And let's dump out let's look at what information we've got on the process that this API provides. So you can see we've got a few different properties. One is to get the modules that are part of the process. One is to get the threads. We'll do the threads in a minute. Another is to get information about the process or information about the system that this log file was collected on. So for now, let's get some information about the process and dump that out. So we go to the process information event, and from there you can see we've collected various things about the process, its command line, its ID, its name, the session it was running in, those kinds of things. Let's dump out the process name for this and just go ahead and run that. We can see we open the log file, and now we're analyzing the card game process, which is the one we just collected the data on. So great. Now let's go in here and actually start to go through the threads. Oops. And get a little more into the log file. So again, just like the log file gives you access to the processes, the process gives you access to the threads. So we've got an enumerator, a list of threads here. And you can go through these, and just like the process, there's some interesting information on the thread, various IDs. Some of these are, the logger thread ID is an internal ID that we assign so that it's unique across all threads. And then we have a managed thread ID and a native thread ID. These are things that you can use that will connect to maybe data you've collected from other parts of the system. We're going to go and the name as well, if the thread is named. We're going to dump out the native thread ID just to have something to display here. And now when we run this, you can see, okay, we've got the log file, we've got a process, and now we've got, I don't know, 8, 9 threads in that process. So you're starting to see what's actually in that log file. When Justin actually ran through it, we were really only looking at one thread there, but in fact there are actually multiple threads in this application, which we can start to see here using this API. One other thing I should mention while I'm going through this API is the names you see today are not the names we're going to have when we ship. Just like we just got the IntelliTrace name, we're actually now going to go through a renaming and a consistency exercise on these names before we ship the product. Okay, so now we've got log file open, we've got processes, we've got threads. Now let's get in. So that's kind of an intro to the simple object model that I mentioned that's in the log file. Now let's actually dive in and start to get at those events that we've collected. So for this sample, let's just go ahead and count up the number of events that are in here across all threads. So we're enumerating through the threads, and then let's just drop in some code that's a simple collection for collecting some statistics about the events here. So we're basically going to store an event name and a count in that. And then let's go ahead and count up the events. So now what we want to do is for each thread, we want to come in here and we want to get the events that are recorded for those threads. And we call these things that store the events chains. So what we want to do is create a thread chain for this thread. So we're going to call the create thread chain function here, and we want a thread stream event chain is the type of event chain that we want. There's stream and non-stream. The non-stream form loads all the events into memory. The stream form will load them as you read them and discard ones that you're no longer referencing, so you can read large streams without having to load the whole thing into memory and consume a bunch of memory. So we're going to use the stream form here. And then what we need to do now is iterate through that stream and get at the events. And we don't use a enumerable pattern here because we actually want to let you go backwards. We also want to let you store lightweight references to events that are in that stream so that you can access them later, but yet have maybe references to events or portions of the stream without having to have the whole event always loaded into memory. So what we've done here is we've got, the way you enumerate this is we have this concept called event token. And what you do is you get the event token, and then you just enumerate through incrementing that event token as you go. So we're going to start with the first event token. We're going to start with the first valid token. Like Justin said, you can set your log file to discard early events as it gets full. And you want to use the first valid token here so that you're getting the first valid one, which means the first one that hasn't been yet recycled. So we start with that one, and then what we want to do is we want to go all the way to the end. So we want to go until we're after the last token in the chain. And then as for each one of these tokens, we now want to get the event for that. So we're just going to call the on the chain the getEvent API there to translate that token, which is a very lightweight reference, into the actual event. So we're going to get this thing called a chain event, which is going to be which is a base class for the, for all the events that are in here. And then for now, what we're going to do is we're just going to get the name of that event, and we're going to store it into this dictionary up here. So, so let's add the code here to increment the statistics. So this is a simple function that just essentially takes the name, the dictionary, the collection, and the name, and if it's already is in the dictionary, it'll add one to the count. Otherwise, it'll add it to the dictionary with a count of one. So it's just a simple way of keeping track here. And then what we also want to do is dump these out at the end. Oops. But we want to dump them out. I think that's... Yep, okay, great. I think that's, yep. And then we need an implementation of that as well. And all this will do is go through that collection that we have and just write out every entry that's in there with the count so you can see that. So let's go ahead and run this. So now what you see is we've gone through, we've got the process of threads, and now we've counted up each of the events that we've seen across all threads in this log file. And you can see we've got 2,348 method enter events, we've got a bunch of call site events, which are the places where each call occurs in the function. And then a few exceptions occurred in there as well. There's various exception events that are recorded as you're running. So that's great. Let's look a little more at the API now and start to get into understanding what those method events are. So let's look at how we can take these events and actually use them as their specific type of events that they are. So let's actually now change this. Instead of just counting up all the events, let's count the method enter events so we can see what those are. And we'll distribute them by the different methods that are being called. So what I'll do is add another dictionary like that first one up here. There's going to be storage for counting those, and then some code here that we're going to add to actually count up those method enter events. So in the previous code, we were working with the chain event, which is the base class for all events, but doesn't have a lot of interesting methods on it. What we want to do now is we actually want to just, we're interested in just getting the method enter events. So we've got types for each of the different types of events, method enter event, method exit event, call site event, exception event, et cetera. So what we're going to do here is we're going to cast it to a method enter event, and anytime we see one of those, we're going to come in here, we're going to actually now record statistics for the method enter event. And one thing I want to show here first is if we look at the method enter event, and we look at the methods that it provides and the properties that it provides, you can see it's a pretty raw look at the method enter event. So we're able to see the ordinal, that's the order that the event occurred in the log file. We're able to see a token, which is actually a token that you could use to map to the module and the metadata token that this method is in, if you did a bunch of work to keep track of all of that stuff. And then you've got a blob of bytes, which is the data that was collected. So all the parameter data that we saw nicely displayed in the locals window and the outs window is in that blob there. So you can see right off the method enter event, it's kind of hard to use. So what we've done with this API is actually created some helpers for you that we call resolved events. So in this case, it's a resolved method enter event. What that's going to let you do is take that method enter event in its raw form and turn it into something that's going to be more useful for analysis. And I'll show what kinds of things you can do with that here in a second. So let's go ahead and create one. Create this method enter event, and it takes the process that we started from. So we've got that. We're enumerating through the processes. And then we've got the method enter event that we wanted to create a resolved event from. And now what we can do with this resolved event is get access to richer data about the event. You're using this API to do some of the decoding on the event. So now you can start to get the parameters, for example. You can get the method that this method enter event occurred in. You can get back to the original event, of course, and the ordinal is still available. So what we want to do is, for this sample, is let's go ahead and, like I said, count up the number of methods that were called by the name of the method. So let's just get the type name and the method name, and we'll concatenate those together and count up the number of calls. So here we'll get the method, and from the method we can now get things about the method, the name, the parameter names, the parameter type names, those kind of things that are on the method. So here what we care about is the containing type name, and then we're going to do a dot, and we're going to do the method name. So we're going to concatenate those together, we're going to increment statistics about those, and then what we need to do down here is dump those out. So there we go. And if we go ahead and run this, now you'll see, okay, now we've started to get a dump of every method enter that was recorded in the log file and the counts of how many times those things occurred. So you can see, you can get a sense of all the different methods that are called. The one that Justin showed you, the value of ACE, is where there was that problem here. You can see how many times it was called if you're interested in that. And what I want to show now is how we can now use the parameter data and the return value data, so how we can get the data out of these events using this API. So that's the third concept that I talked about at the beginning. We've got the simple object model, which lets us get processing threads. We've got events, which we're looking at here, where we can drill into what the different recorded events were. And then we've got the data aspect, so let's show how we get at the data. So using that value of ACEs function, let's start to dump some information that might help us see the same kind of problem that Justin showed us, but through a different kind of tool. So what we're going to do now is, just instead of counting up all methods, we're just going to count the value of ACEs calls, and we're going to count the number of times those were called with different parameter values. So what I want to do here is, we're going to get rid of some code here because we're going to count it in a slightly different way. So what we're going to do is, we're going to still have that resolved method enter event. We're just going to go by method name now, since we've seen all of them. We saw there's a bunch of interesting data there. We're going to now focus on the value of ACEs. So anytime we see a method name that's called value of ACEs, we're going to go do some additional work here. And what we're going to do is, we're going to build up a string that's going to contain the parameter data. So we're going to drill into the parameter data that was recorded with that event. So we're just going to do a simple string builder here to build up a open parentheses and followed by parameter name equals value pairs here. So like I showed before, on the resolve method enter event, you can actually get the parameters. So we'll get the parameters, and that's just a list that you can enumerate through. So that's what we've done here. We're enumerating through the parameters. All of the data that comes back from these APIs is of type IDataElement, which is a pretty simple type. It just contains essentially three properties: the name of the data element, the type of the data element, and the value of the data element. And they're all as strings. So we're not trying to, we're providing you simple access to the data. We're not providing different types based on the type of the underlying data. You can, of course, translate those strings if you need to, or if you want to do something different with them. But that's what we're providing right now. So as we go through here, what we're going to do is take this parameter, which is an IData element, and we're going to get its name, and then we're going to get its value. So we're going to take its name, and we're going to take its value as well. The other thing I should add here is that we do support complex types where types may have references to other types. And that's what this hasChildren and getChildren functions are called for. I'm not going to show those today, but if you've got an object that's got references to other objects and we've collected those, you can get access to that graph of data through the same IData element. So here we're going to get the value. So we're going to build a string that's name equals value. And then we're going to stick that into our little statistic counter here. So let's go ahead and run that. So now we're seeing just the value of ACEs calls in here. And now we're seeing a distribution based on the different parameters that were passed into them. So there are four calls here where the input was a blackjack hand with a hand total of six, and there was one ace. There's still not quite enough information here to see, well what happened, where might there have been a problem in here. Like Justin showed, there are cases where these functions were sometimes returning the wrong value. So let's go ahead and actually look at how we get the return value out of here. So what I've been showing so far is just method enter. There's no return value at method enter. We actually need to use method exit to get the return value. And what's interesting here is we actually need to pair up the method enter with the method exit so that we can both get the parameter data that was collected at the method enter time and get the return value data that was collected at method exit and show those together as one element in our list of statistics here. So I'm going to take a shortcut kind of approach here that really won't work if your application has exceptions or other things that alter the flow of control, the normal flow of control. So I'm just going to create a stack that's going to keep track of the method enters. Every time we get a method enter, we're going to push it on the stack. Every time we get a method exit, we're going to pop off the stack. And then we're going to count up. Then we're going to extract the data out and count that up. So let's see. Oops. So let's drop in this stack, which needs to be right up here. So we've got a stack. We're just going to keep track of these on. And then what we want to do is for each of the method enters, we want to push the method enter event on that stack. And then at method exit, we want to pair that up with the method enter that's happened. So first thing we need to do, just like we did with method enter event, we now care about method exit events as well. So every time we see a method exit event, we're going to do some work here. First thing we're going to do is just pop the method enter event off the stack. And then I'm just going to do a sanity check here to make sure what I expect to have happen is that the method exit event and method enter event are referring to the same method. And on these raw events, well, as we talked about, there's this token. This token is a unique value that we've created that encapsulates both the module and the metadata token for these methods. So we can compare these, and if they're the same, we know they were the same method. So we're just going to do a simple assert here that tells us there's a sanity check that, yeah, this in this case is working as we expect it to. Like I said, if there were exceptions in here that altered the flow of control, obviously, then you start to not have method exit events and things don't match up. So you have to do a little more processing to make this be a real, to really handle this appropriately. But we give you all those exception events so you can actually write that code as well. Okay, so now we've got the method exit, we've got the method enter. We're going to, again, do the same code where we get the name of the method. We only care about value of aces, so we're going to do the same check. When we get the value of aces, we're going to build up that parameter string like we showed before. And now what we're going to add on here is the return value. We've got the method enter and the method exit events together. And let's add to this string. Oh, sorry, that needs to be down here. So just like we did before, we want to take that method exit event, turn it into a resolved event. So do the same pattern that we just did for method enter. We do it on method exit, takes the process and the method exit event. And what that's going to give us then is access to the decoded data that was collected on method exit. So here we can start to see things like the return value. So we can get that. That's going to be an iData element. We can get the output. So if there are any out params on the function, we've collected those as well. You can get those here. And you can drill in and you can get the method. So you can get the method name and those kinds of things from the exit event. Just like you can on the enter event. So here we want to get the return value. It's going to give us an iData element. And if we got one, obviously some functions return void don't have return values. If it returns void, the iData element is returned as null. So we have a check here. If it's not null, we know we got one. And we're going to just add its name, I'm sorry, its value, onto the end of the string that we're building here. And then we're going to go ahead and count these up, and then we'll dump them out at the end. So let's go ahead and run this. All right, so now we've got a dump that's much like before, except now we've got those return values on the end. And you can start to actually see the same problem that Justin showed here, where we've got a call to value of aces. We passed in a value where the number of aces is 1 in this case, but the function returned 0. So we can actually, here, using this data as well, start to see the same problem that Justin showed, which is that we actually expect this function to return a non-zero value since we've got we're passing in an ace and it's not doing the right thing. So just wanted to kind of show how this works in conjunction with what you saw in Visual Studio, how you can use the extensibility API here to actually drill into what's in that log file. So you can then start to write tools or analysis over the data that you've collected using this. And all of this is available in Beta 2. The API, as I've shown it here, the names of everything are this way in Beta 2. This is a Beta 2 build. And then those names will be changing when we actually ship to be more aligned with the product name. And I guess just to wrap up, we've got I've got a slide here that kind of talks about some ideas that we've had about things that could be built with this extensibility API. There is a command line log dumper tool that we're working on getting released up on Code Gallery. It's not quite ready to be put out there yet, but that should be soon. That will be available to work with Beta 2. So it actually has more extensive code about how to decode all the events in that. So if you're interested, that's going to be a great place to go to look at that. It's called iTrace Reader when it's available. And then there's a list here of just some other ideas of things that we've had that we just haven't had time to do yet that might be interesting for you guys or for you know, to be considered there. And then I just wanted to close with questions, of course, but then also wanted to hear any ideas you guys had about extensibility and what kinds of things you'd be interested in seeing us do to let you make use of this data to build tools on or analysis on top of what we have. So I'll stop here for questions or... So the question is, does it track any memory allocations? And the answer is no, we're not doing anything with memory allocations or anything with the CLR memory tracking. Yeah. Way in the back. Yeah.
Can you enable the profiling and location for applications that are not running under Visual Studio?
Yes. So that's what we do in the test scenario, for example. The tester is just running the application on a machine typically without Visual Studio installed. It does have the test components installed, so as part of the test running components, you get what we call a data collector that enables the collection of this data. So you don't have to have Visual Studio installed on the machine to collect the data. You do need some component like the test runner to be there to enable the collection of the data, to collect the log file up and send it back to for storage with the bug if there's a bug entered about a failed test. I think there was another question back there.
Yeah, when processing a log that's associated with an app that actually crashed, can you easily tell it crashed? Can you zero in on the reason why?
So the question is, can you, when you have a log from a process that's crashed, can you tell it's crashed? We do have all the exceptions in the log file, so you can see those, and you can actually see where they occurred in time. So what you can do there is actually start and go backwards from the end of the log file and look for the exceptions that occurred. So if you're seeing a crash or that's reported as a crash, you can find that the last exception or even the last few exceptions that occurred. No, we don't really have anything that says the application exited because of the unhandled exception in the log file. So, yeah, you'd have to make that connection between, sort of a heuristic kind of analysis.
Why would it be the last event, therefore there wouldn't be an app that exits, so you'd assume a crash?
It might be the last event. I guess it depends on what you have in your exception handling you might have. Yeah. Well, so the question is, what do we expect the interaction to be with other agents that use the CLR Profiling API? And for those people that are familiar with the CLR Profiling API, there can only be one profiler registered for a process at a time. The way our system works is, and the way that's controlled is there's an environment variable that's set, and then the CLR, when it sees that environment variable, loads your profiler. What we do in Visual Studio is we set that environment variable for the process that we're going to launch, so we're not setting it system-wide. So if there's another tool that you have installed that's going to that is using the CLR profiler as well, and it's setting it for an environment for a process that it's doing some work with, that's fine. They should be able to work together. We expect that to happen. Same thing happened. I was going to say same thing happens in test, but now I actually think we set it. I think we set it globally in test because we don't know all the applications the tester may run. So in that case, it's set. It's whichever one's the last one registered in the environment is the one that you're going to get. And there's some work in the test configuration tool that doesn't let you enable multiple collectors that may use the profiling API.
Long term, though, we are working with the CLR team to see if we can come up with an easier solution for having multiple things. I mean, it definitely is not a first-class citizen now, but hopefully it will be long term.
Yeah, John.
Can we get performance or time data on these events? It didn't look like it from the IntelliSense, but
yeah,
that would be nice.
So that's a good question. So the question is, can you get time data on the events? And actually, so for, as you saw the two modes that Justin showed, the low mode and the high mode, or whatever we call them in the UI. On the low mode, which are the framework style events, those actually have a timestamp on them. And you can get that through here. I didn't show any of those events here. In this version of the API, they're called notify point events. And they'll have a new name in the final release. And those do have a time that you can get on them. The code events, the method enter, and those things don't. They only have an ordinal. So you can use the notify point of the low mode framework events to get you close in time to other data you may have collected from the system, but you don't get an exact timestamp for each event.
Could we ask for that?
You can ask for that, yes.
Was there any case study of using this feature against SharePoint development specifically?
The question is, has there been a case study has anyone looked at using this feature with SharePoint development? And I actually don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if Justin.
We have looked at using SharePoint. Because the new version of SharePoint is 64-bit, we do not support 64-bit from an F5 scenario. It probably is the first thing we're going to work on even before we get to native. So hopefully in maybe the service pack timeframe, we'll be able to support that scenario, but we don't support it today. We know SharePoint developers would love to have this feature.
Okay, great.
We'd love to hear more feedback, so as you use the tool, we're available. Please email us if you have any feature requests or any other ideas. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.